At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Cunahan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household. You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Cunahan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
It's one of those details in the case against Brian Koberger that seems too small to matter. Or does it? Your phone quietly searching for a familiar Wi-Fi network. No drama, no flashing neon sign, but in the world of digital forensic, those quiet moments are often the ones that change everything. And in this case, it was a single handshake between Brian Koberger's phone and a router broadcasting one particular name that we're about to dive into. What was that name of that router? The Mad Greek. Yeah, where two of the victims worked. There's a lot of data on Koberger's phone that just doesn't exist. And comparing that to many of the cases we follow where the digital footprint seems pretty obvious and kind of shocking that no one even made an attempt to delete it. Koberger made an attempt, and likely a successful one at that, because a lot of the data, digital footprint, it's just not there. You can tell it was there, but you can tell it's been wiped, and wiped in a way that makes it non-recoverable, at least most of it. But there are little glimmers here, little pieces of the story that many are digging into, and many are finding answers, including some folks at Cellebrite, who can say definitively his phone connected, or at least saw, the Mad Greek network. Now, what does that mean? We're going to break this all down in case technology is not your thing. It means that at some point he was near the Bad Greek, which is not a crazy thing to guess. I mean, it's not that big of a community. He's a vegetarian. They have vegetarian options. He's a professor in the general area. And if you're just out living your life in any way, shape, or form, it's likely at some point in time you might have come near this network where your phone then goes and says, you know, hey, this is on the network. And if you click on it and you know the password, or if there is no password, you connect to it. Like, if you do it right now, if there's people around you, if you live in a neighborhood, if you're not secluded to the middle of nowhere, go to Wi-Fi networks. You will find many of them. Just just waiting for you to connect. And you may be kind of disturbed by the names some of your neighbors give them. I like to change mine all the time to very disturbing things that make my neighbors question why they are currently still living in the neighborhood. I'm kidding, I don't. It's very normal. But just think about that for a second. What does this mean? It looks like it could be a big deal. Or is it just a red herring? He passed by. So did thousands of people who've never eaten at the Mad Greek. If you look at their phones, you will find, past that Wi-Fi, you'll find thousands of networks in your phone, maybe tens of thousands of networks in your phone data that you never connected to, but your phone data says you were near. And in a case like this, every little breadcrumb matters. And that's why we're talking about it. The Mad Greek, if you're just starting to pay attention to this, wasn't just any local spot in Moscow, Idaho, where all of this went down. It was the place where two of the victims worked. And when Cellbrite's forensic examiners went line by line through the phone's data, they found that network in its history. They didn't say it proved he sat down there and had a vegetarian pizza with a diet right. No, they didn't say it put him there for sure. They don't say it put him in conversation with anyone. What they said was simple. His phone had at some point recognized and likely connected to the Mad Greek's Wi-Fi. Not a rumor, not a memory. That is a digital artifact of all of this. To understand why this matters, you have to appreciate how your phone behaves when you're not paying attention. Every few seconds, it's scanning. It's basically asking, do I know any of you? To all the routers that it's seeing. And if it does, then you have the setting checked to connect. It tries to connect to these networks that it knows automatically. So you have better Wi-Fi. It does it at the grocery store, at your friend's house, at the coffee shop where you once asked for the password. Your device stores those networks like a Rolodex with timestamps and when you last shook hands with them. And that's exactly what the forensic team saw at the Mad Greek. Why is it important? Because of what else was in the phone and what wasn't. The Cellbrite team, Heather and Jared Barnhart, weren't just looking at his saved networks. They were mapping behavior. And they found what they described as abnormal gaps in his data on both his phone and his school-issued computer. Windows logs that should have been recording activity between November 11th and 16th. Guess what? Dead silent. Chrome history entries missing exactly when downloads occurred. They told the court those gaps could be consistent with cleanup or anti-forensic techniques. That's a posture of someone trying to control their digital shadow. It's like scrubbing footprints off a dirt path. But here's the thing about being human. You never scrub everything. Somewhere, there's always a missing little spot. And for Koberger, one of those missed spots was the digital memory of a restaurant where two victims worked. Now, in January 23, before any of this forensic detail was public, a former employee told People that Koberger had been in the Mad Greek at least twice, ordering his vegan pizza. And that statement exploded online. And the owner issued a public denial, saying she had no memory or record of him ever being there, and pleaded the reporters to stop harassing her staff. The story died in a fog of conflicting human memory. A month later, the phone's memory entered the chat. And here's where it gets technical. Forensic tools like Cellbrite can pull not just the visible known networks list from a phone setting, but also buried system files containing the network's name, the SSID, the router's unique identifier, the BSSID, and the last time the device associated with it. An Android that lives in config and log files. An iOS, it's stored in the keychain and diagnostic dumps. The report didn't print the raw data, but the examiner's phrasing, passively logged, suggests an actual association event, not just seeing the network in the air. And that's a key difference. Seeing a network means you were nearby at once. Joining it means you were within the router's limited bubble, like inside or just outside. Consumer-grade routers in a small restaurant like the Mad Greek have a practical range of 50 to maybe 150 feet indoors. To join, you have to be inside that radius, and you usually need the password unless it's open, which means either they got it at some point or it was stored from a prior visit. This isn't a case where your phone connects to Starbucks Wi-Fi from a block away. It's a unique SSID tied to a single place. And if the examiners possibly more than once, as her comment is accurate, or if it is accurate, that suggests multiple joint events, more than just one accidental brush. That's just one tile in the mosaic. The same phone was part of a larger behavioral pattern that night. The FBI's CAST expert mapped it, active around 2:47 a.m. using a tower southeast of his apartment, then radio silence at 2:54 a.m. Not a dead battery, not a dropped call, full communication blackout. And then 4:48 a.m. it came back. That window lines up precisely with the estimated time of the murders. Separate unsealed records show that at 12:26 a.m. he searched for the local police dispatch feed on Broadcastify. It's not bedtime scrolling, that's operational. Now put yourself in the mindset the data describes. You're someone who spent months studying crime formally in a PhD program, and privately, through your own obsessions, you've been driving by the victim's house late at night, over and over. Your school computer goes quiet for days. Your phone links to a restaurant where two of the victims work. On the night in question, you're awake past midnight looking up police radio. Then you vanish from the network just before 3 a.m. and reappear 2 hours later. Those are choices. Those are rehearsals executed as reality. The Mad Greek artifact doesn't tell us what he ordered or if he made eye contact with anyone, but it adds a point on the map of his known world. It places him inside, or close enough to connect to the environment of two people who would later be murdered. And because it survived the larger digital cleanup, it stands out as one of those mundane oversights that prosecutors love. Not because it's a smoking gun, but because it's an unforced error in an otherwise careful pattern. And the rest of that pattern is worth talking about. On the school computer, Windows logs and the SRUM data missing for the key window, even though it was a normal academic week. Chrome history gaps coinciding with downloads, suggesting private browsing or deliberate deletion. And then, of course, on the phone, the abnormal gaps, the radio silence during the crime, the phone scanner search, the connection to the Mad Greek, all of it framed by repeated cell site hits near the victim's house in the weeks before. What does that say about motive? Well, nothing directly. Digital evidence? Well, it does sometimes, but not necessarily here. He didn't necessarily do the search of how to kill college girls in a house. You know, it wasn't about knife work. It was a breadcrumb that he connected to a network. This is someone who thought he could choreograph every variable. His movements, his device activity, his digital exhaust. Someone who believed that control could be total. The forensic team's job was to show the jury where that belief cracked. There's another human element here, too. When the restaurant's name started bouncing around the news, the owner and the staff became unwilling characters in a national crime story they never asked to be part of. The owner's denial may be honest. Human memory is flawed, especially when you serve hundreds of people. The phone's memory is flawed, too. It doesn't know why it connected or what happened after. Holding both truths is only responsible way. It's the only responsible way to tell this part of the story. And that's the point I keep coming back to. The Mad Greek, the log, isn't about proving a relationship. It's about proving familiarity. Phones don't save networks by magic. Phones, it's data. It's there or it's not. He didn't type in the Mad Greek and suddenly the network showed up on a log. He was close, very close to it, at some point in time. The level of interaction, that's the point in question. And I don't think it's hard for anyone to believe that at some point in the weeks leading up before the murders, that he knew more about them than we will ever know. He hit his tracks well enough. And he was close enough to that router in that restaurant to shake its hand. That's it. It's a case that's built on connecting thousands of tiny dots. And this one matters. Because when you stack it next to the other dots, the surveillance drives, the wiped logs, the midnight police scanner search, the communications blackout, It stops being a trivial detail. It becomes part of the architecture of the crime. Not a pillar, but a brick. And sometimes it's the overlooked bricks that keep the whole wall standing. Tell me what your thoughts are in the comments section. The Mad Greek is a quiet character in this story. How big of a role did it play? I don't know. I think some of the digital data is telling us more than we were aware of, more than even investigators were aware of. And I think we're going to continue to find more out. Even though obviously he's admitted the crimes now and is in prison for the rest of his life. The whole how, when, where, those questions still linger. And we're going to keep doing our best to try.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
It is the part that no one wants to talk about, but it might be the most important. Because by now, the story of Brian Koberger isn't just about what he did. It's about what he didn't do, what no one did, and all the moments where this could have been stopped, but wasn't. Think about it. Reports of him circling the King Road house more than 20 times. A prior break-in in Pullman that looked like a dry run. Was it him? Tinder messages that went dark fast. Police scanner searches hours before the murders. Women's ID cards found stashed in the glove box like souvenirs of people who don't know they've ever been chosen. And that, all of that. And no one connected the dots. But how do you connect the dots if you don't know there's a dot there? Because Koberger did a lot of this covertly. In hindsight, you can look at it. You can say it's easy to point fingers after the fact, but if we don't ask the hard questions now, then what exactly are we waiting for? In this chapter, we're going to ask some uncomfortable but necessary questions. How do we keep this from happening? What systems failed? What systems worked according to plan and still allowed this to happen? What warning signs were missed? And why is it so darn hard to intervene before a line is crossed? Joining me again is psychotherapist and expert on violent offenders and author of the book, The Minds of Mass Killers. Get it wherever you get books. We're digging into the gap between behavior and accountability and asking whether this case was a tragedy or a failure. Siobhan, let's start there. I want to talk about his pre-crime behavior a bit, because there's a lot of it. I mean, when we're looking at the full scope of his pre-crime behavior, whether that be from the stalking of the house to the ID cards. But if we go back even further, we go back to the time where, you know, he stole his sister's cell phone and then tried to sell it for allegedly, you know, heroin money at the local mall kiosk. With that having been his action, his dad turned him in to the police for it. He got a slap on the wrist. But is there more? Obviously, I think Koberger's parents probably did the best they could with the knowledge that they had. I don't have a lot to criticize them about. But in the future, I mean, you got that sort of thing going on with your own kid and your own household that seems to have no emotional reaction to doing something like that hurts a close loved one. What do you do in that case as a parent or as a sibling that, okay, he did this. He doesn't seem to show any remorse for it. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it's also like, the hell's wrong with this guy?
Yeah, you stay grounded in reality that you have a very different sort of kid. And I would tell parents, you know, when they're struggling with what's normal, what's not normal, how do I cope with this? What kind of discipline do we implement? Parents need to go to therapy, not because they're doing anything wrong or that there's anything wrong with them, but they need some professional help on how do we cope with this, because every case is going to be unique, so there's not a formula. But definitely they did the right thing by calling law enforcement and reporting it, because you do, when your kids do something that's, you know, antisocial, it's harming someone else, they need to have consequences, and they need to have consequences both inside the family and outside of the family. And so they did the right thing. Yeah, I don't see that they did anything wrong with this guy, but there are just certain things, you know, people like this are very, very secretive. And I guarantee you his family had no idea of his dark fantasies because he didn't talk about it. He didn't let them know. And even if he, you know, if they had put him in therapy, which of course I say is always a good idea, but he wouldn't have told the therapist any of that either. Mm-hmm. So when we look at how could people intervene, it's really tough with this kind of person because of their secretiveness.
Well, and also, he's someone who consequences don't really seem to matter to him, or only certain things do. Only certain things would trigger someone like him to seemingly get some sort of reaction out of him. So stealing his sister's phone, being caught with it, I don't think he cared. Yeah. There seemed to be a lot of things that just, even if it was socially wrong and he knew it, he didn't really care, even if he was caught. So how do you get through to somebody like that? Especially, I mean, that so many parents, I think, in this situation where they get a kid that's, you know, it's out there. And I'm just, the clinical term out there, as I'm using. But he's just someone who can't seem to be reached, I think, is how I would think of it as a parent. I can't get through to him. I can't, no matter what, this is not working. It did seem during the testimony, during the victim impact statements, that dissing him like he was a high school freshman, you know, that didn't fit in, seemed to make an impact on him when Olivia Gonzalez went up there and just eviscerated him like a mean girl. And I thought it was wonderful because it seemed to actually strike a bit of a nerve. But other than that, I mean, these people seem to have very bizarre places where they are triggered to get a reaction that is negative and visceral that they actually feel.
Yeah, I think what you saw there is the narcissism. Mm-hmm. With, you know, how dare they insult me because I really am superior over everyone else. And so you'd get a little bit of a, you know, that would feel like a sting to him. Mm-hmm. But the psychopathy, that's really a brain difference. So he's got a lot of things about him. He came out of the chute with a different kind of brain. But they really don't learn from punishment. And that's one of the key factors of the personality, is they don't feel the same fear that normal people feel, which is why they'll do these really risky things that most people would just not ever do, you know. Mm-hmm. They don't have empathy, and they don't learn from punishment. So if you're raising a psychopathic kid, man, that's tough, because all the things that work with your other kids don't work with them.
Not every, maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to say not every psychopath turns out to go and kill or be a complete menace to society. I'm sure they leave a wake of destruction, but how do they learn then? How, if punishment doesn't make them learn, and I mean, what does tell them when something is bad and you shouldn't be doing this, that actually works and makes them not want to do it?
Some of them learn very early on that life just goes better for them when they don't break the law, and they're the people that go into politics and the legal profession, you know, they become ministers.
Well, that's comforting.
And so, definitely not all psychopaths take the road of violence. They just don't need to, because they find ways to manipulate other people and succeed and make money without becoming violent. But it's really interesting why some seem to pick that up, that life is going to go better for me if I don't break the law, and others don't. And you can throw in there are some probably other elements like sadism, and we see that with some people. And when you know, with mass killers, you certainly see sadistic qualities where they actually get a sense of pleasure from harming others. And I guess you could say there are psychopaths who don't really care about others, but they're not sadistic. Mm-hmm. And that's another variable. So many variables with this personality stuff. It's fascinating.
It is. And I think that's the real problem, because we like to tightly wrap a problem. Let's fix it. Let's put it right in this box and here we go. There's the solution. And there really isn't a solution to this. I mean, if you want to go into like dystopian type society, I mean, would there ever be a way to mark this type of behavior? I mean, without some sort of infraction, you know, I mean, it's one of the things we've been talking about when we've been discussing passing the trash with educators from district to district and things being reported, but never getting to a criminal level. And it just never follows them. It never goes anywhere. I mean, should this be something more on medical radars, on doctors' radars, where, you know, we do take inventory when we go in for a checkup. Okay, you were on this, I mean, it's a very quick checkup, and a lot of it is the relying on your own self-reporting.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, if you're diagnosed of something, you know, and you get this sort of a diagnosis, it's usually after something happened that you're trying to figure out what's going on. But should there be more that we do in terms of looking and understanding people psychologically, just as we do physically, to, you know, parse out these sort of things earlier on and identify if they're actually there, and then take routes of, okay, this is how this person thinks, this is how we should help them navigate life, and hopefully they won't go into the serial killer route, but they're pretty apt to if we don't do something. Should there be more of that, just notating from actual professionals, not because of a police visit or a CPS report, just on your checkup? Let's dig into this deeper. Obviously, it costs money. There's a lot of things that would prevent it. But I would think that maybe we could get a better grasp on our society in terms of our mental health if there was a little more concern there.
It's a really hard call. You know, if we use Koberger as a case study, let's say he really fits the criteria for autism. That fits millions and millions and millions of people now. And, you know, do we do a pretty good job at screening for that, for neurodivergence? I think certainly pediatricians look for it now. Mm-hmm. But were there any signs? Were there signs of OCD? Yes, but that fits millions and millions of people too.
Yeah, like you gotta keep digging. Like we have our surface level, like it's autism, it's a spectrum, it covers everything, you know, and then, okay, well, we got the OCD. Okay, that's still fairly surface level when we're talking about how deep this goes. I guess my point is, do we need to find a way to dig deeper into this? And I'm wondering if technology will help us find ways of doing this more than just the doctor's got his pad or he's just typing on the what's going on here? Okay, I got my next one in 5 minutes. I got to get you in and out. You know, I'm just wondering if we're going to have ways to detect this sort of thing, maybe through some sort of AI that can see things and understand things and little minute things that the average doctor just doesn't pick up on because they're doing 50 other things.
I
just wondering.
I don't see any way a doctor could. I mean, you know, they've got 15 minutes, preferably 10, you know, and they're going to hit the big milestones.
Yeah.
And do they even have time to screen? This was something I was reading in a medical journal this week. Do they have time to really screen every teenager they see for substance abuse? And we're saying they need to do that. And it's like, do they have time to go into their sexuality? And are they having sex? And are they using protection? I mean, you'd need a 2-hour doctor appointment, to do that deep assessment. And what are their sexual fantasies, which they're not going to talk about, even if asked. So I don't see any practical way that we can do more in the healthcare system other than look for, you know, one of the big red flags for people who are psychopathic is, as children, do they hurt animals? Mm-hmm. And so if a parent came in saying, my kid has this kind of behavior problem, I would think even at this point, they're going to get referred to a therapist by a medical doctor. And then a therapist is hopefully going to tune in more on these other areas of concern. And is this a kid we need to watch more closely? But yeah, I think we're were a long way away from scanning everybody's brain in childhood. You know, and there are brain differences in psychopaths that can be observed. Mm-hmm. I think the research is still fairly young on this, but there are speculations about the brain differences that can be seen on fMRI.
Yeah.
But that's not something I think the civil rights people would be all over it if you're trying to say, we're going to take everybody and scan your brains now.
Yeah.
You know,
I know. It's insane. But it's like what we do seem to have some ways that we could do it, but it would violate some privacy rights, and it would change. I'm going to say change. It would change the way we do some things. The same as it would change some things if mandatory reporting actually meant mandatory reporting. It would function better. But there's always, you know, there's always the reasons. There's always the things that would put a hindrance to any of those things following through. And they're logical. They're valid. At the end of the day, we're dealing with every human being who is dramatically different and trying to keep the bad ones out of the good flock.
It's hard. And it when is. You look at like the Devil's Den case, I mean, I'm sure there were people, I would guess, in the school system where there were complaints about him that would like to have been able to pass that information on, but they were prohibited by legal restraints on how much they can share. I know one of the government systems I used to work in that when they were screening new applicants, they could ask like one or two questions, and that's all they were allowed to ask. They weren't allowed to ask any further background information, which is unfortunate because I think there were people that got in as employees that probably should have been screened out, but there were all these legal requirements about how much information they could request.
And they know how to work those systems. They know how to just get far enough to either check the box if they want it checked or not have it checked and keep on moving. And that's been the way they've survived for so long. Siobhan Scott, The Mind of Mass Killers. Check it out wherever you get books. Thank you, as always, for coming on and giving us your insight on this and the many cases we cover here. There is no perfect system. We know that. No algorithm, no checklist, no psychic hotline that can tell you when someone's going to kill. But that doesn't mean we throw up our hands and pretend there's nothing we can do. Because here's the thing. Brian Koberger didn't exist in a vacuum. He was on a campus, in a class, teaching students, swiping on Tinder, buying coffee, sitting in rooms with people who sensed something was off but didn't know what to do with that feeling. I think we've all been there before, and I didn't know what to do either. I still don't know what to do in many cases. That's the question. It's not a why didn't people act, it's what are they supposed to do? We don't have a system that has anything in place or a clear path for when you see something like this and you say something like that, what you should expect after, or what that person's to do once you've said something. At the core of all this, it's a hesitation, the discomfort, the silence. We don't have a cultural or institutional framework for what to do with almost dangerous. We either wait until it's too late or we get uncomfortable labeling someone as a threat before there's blood on the floor. Siobhan explained, though, the signs were there. They were always there. The stalking, the control, the internal rehearsal. We need better tools to catch them and, more importantly, the courage to use them. So the question becomes, what do we do with the next guy who's weird in all the wrong ways, who sends one to many disturbing messages on Tinder, who circles a home 20 times at night? Do we wait and hope we're wrong, or do we act and risk being early? Because at the end of the day, prevention isn't about knowing. It's about deciding when close enough becomes too close. It's not a conversation about Koberger. It's about every red flag we convince ourselves to ignore until the sirens come. Until it's already over. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section of this video on YouTube. And if you've not already, press subscribe there or wherever you download podcasts. You can find us anywhere you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to get in on that. Same search for YouTube as well. Love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.